Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today, as you can imagine, a week before the election, there's a lot of politics. So we're going to start with the celebrity section. We've got a little bit of royals to catch up on and then spend the majority of our time on politics. Things could change next week, so we're going to update everybody on what is going on in the world of politics. Let's start with a little lighter news. Travis Kelce's whole family went to see Taylor Swift's Miami show without him, and he had terrible FOMO. This is by Casey Wickman, published on October 23rd. You ever get that feeling that everyone is hanging out without you and having a really awesome time? Travis Kelce hasn't just felt it, he's lived it, as his family, including brother Jason Kelce and his wife Kylie Kelce, the couple's daughters Elliot and Wyatt, and mom Donna Kelce, as well as a gaggle of assorted friends, all headed to Miami to watch Travis's girlfriend Taylor Swift kick off the final leg of her Eras tour over the weekend. On the latest episode of New Heights, the podcast that the brothers co-host, published Wednesday, Jason discussed the concert and defended his honor in response to speculation that he'd taken a little snooze mid-show. "We gotta talk about it," Travis said, appalled, on the pod. "You took a nap at the Eras tour. What is that all about?" "I did not take a nap," Jason said. "Travis, you know I did not take a nap." Travis kept pushing, adding another chapter to the already lengthy book of him being super proud of Swift. "The show is electric. It's the greatest show that's ever been on stage, and you're over there falling asleep." Among Jason's guests was his pal and former Philadelphia Eagles teammate Bo Allen, who retired in 2022. As Jason explained, the group was in a suite that was very visible to the rest of the crowd, so he felt like he was kind of in a fishbowl, like everybody's staring at me. He'd been dancing with Elliot, who's 5, and then took a seat when his eldest daughter went to his wife. He closed his eyes and vibed a little, which is when Alan and his camera struck. "Sometimes I feel like everyone is a sexy baby and I'm a monster on a hill," Alan wrote on social media, borrowing a lyric from Swift's Anti-Hero, alongside a photo of Jason, seated, eyes closed. Fans gave Jason a wake-up call, accusing him of taking a little nap. "Not so," Jason said. "I'm just sitting here and I'm feeling it. I'm tapping my thigh and I'm just in the moment listening to the song. And then all of a sudden I go on Twitter and I see this fucking picture. Like, dude, what the fuck? Like, I'm not even sleeping and I can prove it to you. There's evidence in this photo that I'm not sleeping." That evidence, he said, is his right hand, evidently blurred in motion above his knee. "You can't sleep with your hand hovering above your knee. It's impossible. I'm not Major Payne. I can't sleep with my eyes open, let alone my hand hovering over my knee." Jason attended his first Eras Tour show over the summer when he took in 2 performances at Wembley Stadium and also happened to meet Prince William, Princess Charlotte, and Prince George. At the time, he compared seeing Swift to going to a Bruce Springsteen show, and it's safe to say he's now a hardcore Swiftie. The Miami show, he said, was even better. "The rain and every... dude, it was like on another level," he gushed. "I texted you halfway through it like, dude, this rain, Tay is killing it. Dude, when Reputation came on and she came out in the new outfit and the rain was coming down and the place could have fucking erupted, the amount of energy was insane." Travis, apparently satisfied, conceded that Jason was just feeling the groove. "You know I played jazz," Jason said. "Sometimes you close your eyes." "Dude, every jazz solo I ever saw you play," Travis confirmed. Despite the photographic friendly fire that coincided with Jason's moment of zen, Jason said that the family had a good time at what was the first time Donna, Elliot, and Wyatt had seen Swift play live. "Not only did everyone have a good time, but everybody has been texting over the last couple days since then. Like, dude, she's just incredible. The show's incredible," he said. "Miami was another level of it. I'm excited for her to be back out on tour, this final leg of the Eras Run tour. Pretty awesome. It was an incredible trip. Keep killing it, Tay." Travis echoed him. "Keep killing it." Of course, Travis also voiced his jealousy about not making it to the show due to, you know, work obligations, which is to say that he was prepping with the Kansas City Chiefs for their game Sunday against the San Francisco 49ers, a Super Bowl rematch in which Kansas City once again bested the Niners 28-18. "Man, I wish I was there," he said. "I wish I was there." He added that he had more pals at the show who weren't sitting with his family. "I had all the FOMO in the world with the entire family and a lot of our friends being there," he said, all of whom also had a good time in the Florida downpour. "Shout out to Tay-Tay for powering through a few rain shows there," he said. And since the Kelce family, and by extension, New Heights, can count themselves among Swift's top fans, a few references to Travis's better half snuck in here and there, including a really deep cut. No, that wouldn't be a line of bad blood that Travis trilled out Wednesday's episode, seemingly unable to help himself when Jason referenced bad blood between teams later in the show. The pod's official social media account got in a real, if you know, you know, Swifty inside joke, hitting Alan with the old yes and. Alan retweeted that Jason said, "These days I haven't been sleeping," borrowing from Swift's song Back to December, to which the New Heights account responded, "He wasn't asleep, his mind was alive." And he didn't even have to get LASIK to get there. What a guy. A little more, Travis Kelce. He says his mustache is quote-unquote magic and has an aura. Taylor Swift has not weighed in. This is by Casey Wickman on October 22nd. With the amount of care and forward planning that Taylor Swift puts into her life and career, like all those Easter eggs in the lead up to an album's release, it's no surprise that her boyfriend Travis Kelce is just a little bit type A, too. Kelce, who plays tight end for the currently undefeated Kansas City Chiefs, has a 5-minute plan for gameplay, a 5-year plan for diversifying his career, and when it comes to his facial hair, a 5-month plan, or however long the NFL season lasts. Kelce dished about his meticulously maintained mustache in an interview with People published Monday. It started as a bit of a joke, and then it became both a tribute and a superstition. "I grow out the stash every training camp, or at least I have the past 3 or 4 years since we've been making these title runs," he told the outlet, in honor of Coach Andy Reid. He is the walrus. Kansas City head coach Reid, who led the team since 2013, including 3 Super Bowl wins within the past 4 seasons, is known for his trademark facial hair. Unlike Kelce, who has sported the style only in season in recent years, Reid rocks the mustache all year long. "He's got that thing looking beautiful every single day," Kelce said admiringly of Reid's hirsute adornment. Kelce's look started as a goof a few years back. He thought it'd be funny to roll into preseason training camp with a mustache, but now he grows it to keep the tradition alive. While Swift, if you trust Kansas City quarterback Patrick Mahomes, is the brains behind Kelce's current hairstyle, his commitment to keeping his facial hair going strong all season is entirely his own. "There's always magic to the stash," he said. "There's an aura around it. It just brings success." Next up, Jennifer Lawrence is pregnant with her 2nd child. This is by Eve Beatty, published on October 20th. Just last year, Jennifer Lawrence announced her willingness to return to the Hunger Games franchise, saying, "If Katniss ever could come back into my life, 100%. But right now, she has an even more demanding project on her plate, the upcoming birth of her 2nd child. The news came after the Lawrence, once the highest-paid female actor in the world, was spotted in Los Angeles on her way to dinner. Her appearance spurred speculation that the 34-year-old might be expecting, with her representative confirming the pregnancy to Vogue on Sunday. This will be the 2nd child for Jennifer Lawrence and husband Cook Maroney, who tied the knot on October 19, 2019. Does that make last night's dinner an anniversary celebration? Perhaps. "Maroney is the greatest human being I've ever met," Lawrence said the year they wed. "He really is, and he gets better." The two welcomed their 1st child, Cy Maroney, in April 2022. In the years surrounding her 1st pregnancy, Lawrence took a break from the business, telling Vanity Fair in 2021 that "Everybody had gotten sick of me. I'd gotten sick of me. I'd just gotten to a point where I couldn't do anything right. If I walked a red carpet, it was, why didn't she run?" In recent years, the star has been far more elusive, appearing in fewer films than she did during her award-studded rise to the top in the 2010s. That retreat began even before she realized she was pregnant with her 1st child, a revelation she had while in New Orleans to film Causeway, a 2022 release in which she played a veteran injured during the war in Afghanistan. It was coming out of my performance in all these different creative ways, but I wasn't conscious of it, she told the New York Times in 2022. Then I went back, and when I'm home with my husband making this family, I'm so happy, she said then. Since then, she's spoken less about her personal life and family. It's so scary to talk about motherhood, only because it's so different for everybody, she told Vogue in 2022. If I say, it was amazing from the start, some people will think it wasn't amazing for me at first and feel bad. My heart has stretched to a capacity that I didn't know about, she said then. I include my husband in that, and then they're both just like, out there, walking around, crossing streets. He's going to drive one day. He's going to be a stupid teenager and be behind the wheel of a car. And I'm just going to be like, good night. You know, like, who sleeps? Just a little bit of royal news this week. King Charles acknowledges Britain's painful past at Commonwealth Summit. This is by Katie Nicol on October 25th. On Friday, King Charles addressed the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa, delivering one of the most important speeches of his reign so far. Charles, who succeeded his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, as head of the Commonwealth, addressed Commonwealth leaders, foreign ministers, and dignitaries during his first CHOGM as king following a successful tour of Australia in recent days. After attending the formal opening ceremony with Queen Camilla, Charles delivered an address in which he touched on some of the major issues facing the Commonwealth. In his debut speech to the 56-member group, the king spoke about slavery and Britain's role in the slave trade, saying, "None of us can change the past, but that leaders could learn from history and find creative ways to right inequalities that endure." As calls grow for Britain to pay reparations to the families of those affected by the transatlantic slave trade, Charles used his speech to play the role of peacemaker, saying that leaders should find the right way and the right language to address inequality and Britain's role in it. The tensions around the subject have overshadowed recent royal tours, including Prince William and Kate Middleton's tour of the Caribbean. However, while King Charles did not issue a formal apology, he acknowledged the pain of the past and the need to move forward, telling the Commonwealth heads of government, "Our cohesion requires that we acknowledge where we have come from. I understand from listening to people across the Commonwealth how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate. It is vital, therefore, that we understand our history to guide us to make the right choices in the future." From the 1500s, the UK benefited from the slave trade and transported over 3 million enslaved Africans to the Caribbean and North America, according to Parliament's heritage collections. While Britain abolished slavery in the Commonwealth in the 19th century, some Commonwealth leaders have called on the UK to pay financial compensation for its role in the slave trade. These reparations could potentially run into trillions of pounds. King Charles did not directly refer to slavery during his address, but said, "Let us choose within our Commonwealth family the language of community and respect, and reject the language of division." Previously, King Charles had spoken of his personal sorrow at the suffering of so many at the 2022 summit, and there was huge pressure on him to get the tone right at Friday's summit. Aides say that he has demonstrated his ability to be both an international statesman and a peacekeeper, while leaving the politics to Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who was also in attendance. While King Charles is head of state, the monarch is not supposed to express political opinions and must uphold the government's position. The UK government has not issued an apology for slavery, with Starmer telling leaders at the summit that Britain must acknowledge our shared history, especially when it's hard. He added in an interview with the BBC, "We can't change our history, but we should certainly talk about our history." Charles, who paused his cancer treatment while visiting Australia and Samoa, has kept the focus of his addresses at CHOGM to having open conversations. The theme of this year's event in Samoa was One Resilient Future, Transforming Our Commonwealth. The king also used the summit to focus on the Commonwealth's attention on climate change, warning that if we do not take action, then inequalities across the Commonwealth and beyond will only be exacerbated with the potential to fuel division and conflict. Charles also echoed the promise he made in his ascension speech, vowing to serve the Commonwealth and its people for however many years God grants me. The king delivered another address Friday evening at a dinner for the heads of government. The summit concludes Charles and Camilla's overseas tour, which included a mostly successful 6-day-long visit to Sydney. It was King Charles' first visit to Australia as monarch, and despite some anti-monarchy protestations, the trip had been deemed a success. The royal couple was said to be delighted with the reception they received in Australia, where crowds gathered at the Sydney Opera House to greet them as they closed the tour with a visit to the world-famous landmark to mark its 50th anniversary. We are going to transition into the politics by sharing some stories that are actually in the celebrity section, but kind of cross into politics. So you'll see what I mean. So, for example, this first headline, Beyoncé officially endorses Kamala Harris at Houston hometown rally. It's time to sing a new song. This is by Casey Wickman. This is Texas, and Beyoncé aims to help Kamala Harris hold 'em, voters. The K-Hive has finally met the Bayhive. After reportedly personally blessing the use of her song Freedom as Harris's theme music for her presidential campaign, Beyoncé appeared alongside Harris at the Democratic candidate's rally in Houston Friday night. An energetic crowd that the Harris campaign estimated was more than 30,000 strong gathered at Shell Energy Stadium Friday night, taking in speakers and videos focused around reproductive rights, as well as a performance by Willie Nelson and a speech by Texas Representative Colin Allred, who was running against sitting Republican Senator Ted Cruz in the state Senate race. Bay's mom, Tina Knowles, took the stage and delivered an impassioned speech in support of Harris. Following up on the endorsement of Harris and running mate Tim Walz, she shared back in July, on the same day President Joe Biden announced that he would step aside and endorse Harris to take his place. Knowles finished off the speech by announcing that she was so honored to welcome two of my daughters, Kelly and Beyoncé. Beyoncé and Destiny's Child bandmate Kelly Rowland, who moved in with the Knowles family at a young age and calls Knowles Mama T, took to the stage to Destiny's Child Independent Women Part 1. After remarks by Rowland, Beyoncé addressed her hometown crowd by bellowing H-Town in greeting. She called Harris a woman who has been pushing for what this country really needs right now. It's impossible not to feel the energy in this room, the community, or the humanity, she said. We are at the precipice of an incredible shift, at the brink of history. I'm not here as a celebrity. I'm not here as a politician. I'm here as a mother who cares deeply about the world my children and all of our children live. A world where we have freedom to control our bodies. A world where we are not divided. Our past, our present, our future meet us here. It's time to sing a song that began 248 years ago, she continued. The old notes of downfall, discord, despair no longer resonate. Our generations of loved ones before us are whispering a prophecy, a quest, a calling, an anthem. Our moment right now, it's time for America to sing a new song. Our voices sing a chorus of unity. They sing a song of dignity and opportunity. As usual, Harris entered the stage to the sound of Beyoncé's Freedom. This time, she was greeted by Queen Bey herself, along with her blaring song. Harris hugged Rowland and then Beyoncé, and then took the podium to stump in a state with some of the nation's most restrictive abortion laws. Until Friday, Beyoncé herself had kept mum on her choice of candidate. Rumors of a performance by Queen Bey on the final night of the 2024 Democratic National Convention back in August turned out to be greatly exaggerated, but months later, in the final days before voters head to the polls, it came to fruition in Bey's hometown. The singer endorsed the Biden-Harris ticket back in the 2020 election and in 2016 headlined a performance with her husband Jay-Z in support of Hillary Clinton's presidential bid. Audiences have long waited for Beyoncé to speak out officially, though she's signaled her support in other ways. According to Billboard, the singer's label sent a cease and desist letter to Donald Trump's campaign earlier in the election cycle, telling the Republican candidate to remove a video using Freedom. The singer's endorsement is more than just symbolic. Her stamp of approval could actually sway voters. A recent poll conducted by Newsweek found that some 40% of surveyed Gen Z voters said that they were more likely, or significantly more likely, to vote for a candidate who had earned Beyoncé's endorsement. Bey joins other powerhouse musical acts such as Taylor Swift, Chappell Roan, Charlie XCX, Bruce Springsteen, and more by voicing her support for Harris. Next up in the celebrity slash politics section, meet Tony Hinchcliffe, the comic whose racist jokes rocked Trump's MSG rally. This is by Savannah Walsh. With roughly a week to go before the 2024 presidential election, there is one thing binding Democrats and Republicans alike: disbelief towards stand-up comedian Tony Hinchcliffe, who bombed on stage Sunday at a rally for Donald Trump's campaign. While performing at New York City's Madison Square Garden, an event that also featured the likes of Melania Trump and Tucker Carlson, Hinchcliffe sparked outrage for his incendiary act, particularly an offensive line about Puerto Ricans. He said, quote, "I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. I think it's called Puerto Rico," end quote, said the 40-year-old comic. His mocking of a key constituency has led to backlash from all sides, but Hinchcliffe has said that comedians should never apologize for a joke. So who is Tony Hinchcliffe? Born in Youngstown, Ohio, Hinchcliffe told Variety earlier this year that comedy was his only escape from his childhood in a rough, tough neighborhood. He was drawn to entertainment in part because of a distant relationship with his father. "Anytime my father, who would visit sometimes, would come around, my goal was to make him laugh because I thought that would make him visit more," said Hinchcliffe. After moving to Los Angeles in 2007, Hinchcliffe began opening for stand-up comedians like Joe Rogan and Jeff Ross, whom he has called a mentor. He also wrote for the Comedy Central roasts of James Franco, Justin Bieber, Rob Lowe, and Bruce Willis. In May, Hinchcliffe sat alongside comics like Kevin Hart and Nikki Glaser to roast Tom Brady on Netflix, which was also home to his 2016 stand-up special, One Shot. Since 2013, Hinchcliffe and Brian Redban have co-hosted the popular Kill Tony podcast, which has nearly 2 million subscribers on YouTube. The weekly live show films outside of Rogan's Comedy Club in Austin, Texas. Hinchcliffe's material appears to have become more political in recent years. Back in 2017, the comic, who was referred to as the King Joffrey of comedy, told Metro, "I have some pro-Trump material, even though I'm not specifically pro-Trump. The material is. I'm pretty much looking at the positives of things." So what did he say at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally? Well, before his headline-making remark about Puerto Rico, Hinchcliffe took aim at, quote, "these Latinos," saying, "They love making babies, too. Just know that. They do. They do. There's no pulling out. They don't do that. They come inside just like they did to our country." Elsewhere in his set, Hinchcliffe floated the idea that Travis Kelce might be the next O.J. Simpson and quipped, "Every day the Democratic Party looked more like a Diddy party." When some of his jokes landed with a thud, Hinchcliffe said, "Republicans are the party with a good sense of humor." So who's mad? Celebrities with Puerto Rican heritage, including Bad Bunny, Jennifer Lopez, and Ricky Martin, have posted their public support for Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris in the aftermath of Hinchcliffe's jokes on social media. Both sides of the aisle have also come out against Hinchcliffe's Puerto Rico joke, including Republican lawmakers like New York Representative Anthony Desposito, who wrote that he is proud to be Puerto Rican on X. He added, "My mom was born and raised in Puerto Rico. It's a beautiful island with a rich culture and an integral part of the USA. The only thing that's garbage was a bad comedy set. Stay on message." Maria Elvira Salazar, a Republican representative from Florida, wrote that she was disgusted by Hinchcliffe's racist comment and that this rhetoric does not reflect GOP values. Fellow Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott wrote, "The joke bombed for a reason. It's not funny and it's not true." Meanwhile, Republican Rep. Carlos Jimenez said, "This is not a joke. It's completely classless and in poor taste." Even the Trump campaign is distancing itself from Hinchcliffe. "This joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign," said Danielle Alvarez, a campaign advisor. Harris's vice presidential running mate Tim Walz called Hinchcliffe a jackwad while on a Twitch stream with Democratic Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez during Sunday's rally. He also criticized Trump's response to Hurricane Maria in 2017. "Does anybody remember how he responded to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? It was absolutely horrific, down there insulting people," Walz said. "Look, I know that the folks who are on here today understand this. People in Puerto Rico are citizens. They pay taxes and they serve in the military at almost a higher rate than anybody else." In response, Hinchcliffe wrote on X, "These people have no sense of humor. Wild that a vice presidential candidate would take time out of his busy schedule to analyze a joke taken out of context to make it seem racist. I love Puerto Rico, and I vacation there. I made fun of everyone, watched the whole set. I'm a comedian, Tim. Might be time to change your tampon. Cortez replied by writing on X, "Can't get over this dude telling someone else to change tampons when he's the one shitting bricks in his Depends after realizing opening for a Trump rally and feeding red meat racism alongside the throng of other bigots to a frothing crowd does unironically make you one of them," adding, "You don't love Puerto Rico. You like drinking pina coladas. There's a difference." Has Hinchcliffe gotten into trouble before? Well, this isn't the comic's first brush with controversy. Back in May 2021, after being introduced at an Austin, Texas gig by fellow comedian Peng Dang, Hinchcliffe used a racial slur on stage while talking about Dang. The remarks were caught on video and widely circulated on social media, resulting in Hinchcliffe being dropped by his talent agency, WME, as well as a few scheduled gigs. The comic, who is now represented by United Talent Agency, has never apologized for the incident. In October 2023, while appearing on the YouTube show Triggernometry, Hinchcliffe accused Dang of being a Chinese spy and theorized that the backlash was an orchestrated attack by the Chinese media. In response, Dang told Variety earlier this year, "I thought most spies gathered classified information related to science, technology, or government affairs. Why would any country send a spy to be a stand-up comedian? What kind of intelligence would I get from doing comedy?" At that moment in time, there was a rise in Asian hate. It was backed by statistics. I know people personally who were injured in Texas. Within the same article, Hinchcliffe doubled down on his comments. "I knew that what I had done was not wrong. It wasn't even the worst thing I did that week," he told Variety in April. "I couldn't believe it when that video came out and was one of my former openers doing it. It was so dumbfounding to me because it was a joke. And my stance is that comedians should never apologize for a joke, should never stop working if everyone comes after them, and should never slow down. In fact, they should utilize anything that happens to them for more material." Our next headline, Elon Musk's alleged talks with Putin raise national security concerns. This is by Caitlin Dewey on October 25th. Elon Musk, now the second largest donor to Donald Trump's re-election campaign and a major figure in the U.S. national security apparatus, has spoken regularly with Russian President Vladimir Putin since 2022, the Wall Street Journal reported. The conversations, which the journal said it confirmed with several current and former officials, involved Ukraine, Taiwan, and assorted business matters, all of which have reportedly made some national security folks nervous. At one point, as a favor to Chinese leader Xi Jinping, Putin asked Musk not to extend satellite internet service to Taiwan, the journal reports. At another point, Musk spoke with Putin's chief propagandist, Sergei Kiryenko, who's been involved in efforts to spread disinformation about the war in Ukraine and the U.S. presidential elections. Musk also told a political scientist that he discussed Ukraine with Putin directly, according to the journal. The tech billionaire had initially voiced strong support for Ukraine and provided free internet in much of the country via SpaceX Starlink satellite service. Over time, however, SpaceX has increasingly restricted the use of Starlink in Ukraine and prevented the country's military from using it as part of offensive operations. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about Elon Musk's ties to Vladimir Putin. Let's continue. The journal's revelations are especially concerning given Musk's deep involvement with both the federal government and Trump's election campaign. Trump reportedly maintains his own personal relationship with Putin, whom he has called smart and savvy. Musk's SpaceX, meanwhile, holds major contracts with U.S. defense, intelligence, and space agencies, and Musk personally holds a top-secret security clearance in connection with that work. The Pentagon put Musk's clearance under temporary review in 2019 after he smoked marijuana during a podcast taping with Joe Rogan. Neither Trump nor Musk have confirmed their dealings with Putin, though Trump did recently tell one interviewer that it would be smart to have such a conversation. He also said he thinks we'll get along with Russia under his administration. Trump has said he'll make Musk part of that administration as well, promising to appoint the tech billionaire to a prominent new position overseeing government efficiency. Musk has contributed nearly $120 million to Trump's reelection via the candidate's campaign and Musk's own super PAC, including $43.6 million in the first 16 days of October alone. That makes him Trump's second largest backer after Timothy Mellon, the heir to the Mellon banking fortune. We are full into the politics section. Our next headline, Trump alum turned Harris advocate says she knows there is now a target on her back. This is by Brian Stelter, October 24th. The Republican Party has long been lacking courage, but profiles in it can still be found among the scores of Trump administration staffers who have come out against their former boss at potentially immense personal cost. One among them, Sarah Matthews, who served as Donald Trump's deputy press secretary until January 6th. On the latest episode of Inside the Hive, Matthews opens up about the cognitive dissonance she experienced as a spokesperson for Trump, recalls how the Capitol riot became her breaking point, and unpacks why she has thrown her support behind Kamala Harris's campaign, even if doing so puts a target on her back. "Donald Trump is so much bigger than just me," she says. "The guilt that I would feel from sitting on the sidelines," Matthew adds, "would have been much greater than the fear that I might feel right now." Matthews, a lifelong conservative, remembers that early into her White House stint, she began to have reservations. "I was never a diehard Trumper. I was never a MAGA type of person, but I was one of those Republicans who thought, well, at least he's better than Hillary. And obviously, I think that that's hard to maintain that kind of cognitive dissonance," she says. "At a certain point, you just kind of start to drink the Kool-Aid and you start to be okay with maybe overlooking some of the red flags. And there were definitely moments where I was working for him, and especially being a spokesperson for him, where I defended things that I'm not necessarily proud of and that I kind of looked the other way." Ultimately, her breaking point was witnessing the former president's reaction to January 6th as a riotous throng of Trump supporters violently stormed the Capitol. "He did not want to lift a finger to call off the mob because he was enjoying what he was seeing. And so it was then that I lost all faith in him," Matthews recalls. "He wasn't disturbed by the violence. I thought this was one of the most horrific things that I have ever witnessed." She quit on the spot. After that, Matthews resumed a less chaotic life in Republican politics, but realized she had a higher calling when over a year later she agreed to testify to the January 6th committee about her experiences. "Still, it wasn't a decision she made lightly. I knew then that I needed to do everything I could to try to help the Harris campaign," she says, "to spread the message, to help create this permission structure for disaffected Republicans like myself that, look, we need to leave Donald Trump behind and turn the page on him." In July 2022, Matthews officially joined the likes of Cassidy Hutchinson, another former member of Trump's White House, on the congressional witness stand, testifying about what she saw on January 6th. But that didn't come without cost. She's potentially sacrificed a career in GOP politics forever, suffered endless online harassment, and may have put a target on her back in the event of a Trump win. "I'm sure that there's a list and I might be on it somewhere," she admits, "but that's why I think it's so important for me to be out there spreading this message of saying, look, I used to support this guy. I used to work for this guy as a spokesperson, and he is no longer the same candidate that he was in 2016 and 2020. He's become even more radicalized because he's not running on making America great again. He's not running on solving problems for everyday Americans. He's running on retribution, and that is what a second Trump term will look like." Our next headline, CNN embraces election night uncertainty. "Nobody has any idea how this is going to end." This is by Natalie Korak. It's looking likely, given the historically close nature of the 2024 presidential race, that major TV networks won't be able to make a call on election night. Not that that would stop Donald Trump. Based on past performance, CNN anchor Jake Tapper tells me in an interview, the network is anticipating Trump declaring victory if he's up on election night, even though all the votes haven't been counted. Still, Tapper and his colleagues remain open to any number of scenarios as results come in because he says nobody has any idea how this is going to end. As the candidates make their final sprint, CNN is gearing up for its Super Bowl. As as Tapper describes it, a culminating political event capping a turbulent election cycle for which the network has, at times, played a crucial role. CNN hosted 13 town halls dating back to the start of the Republican primaries, including a widely panned Trump event, and on Wednesday night will air a Pennsylvania event with Vice President Kamala Harris. Notably, the network produced the June face-off between President Joe Biden and Trump, which Tapper calls the most consequential presidential debate in history. It has never happened before that a candidate's performance was so troubling he was pressured by his own party to drop out of the race, says Tapper, who co-moderated that event with fellow CNN anchor Dana Bash. This election cycle, Bash says, has been really wild. I feel very lucky as someone who loves history and obviously loves journalism to be participating in the journalism that made so much history, says Bash, who also scored Harris's first joint interview with running mate Governor Tim Walz. As for that pivotal Biden-Trump debate, she says, who knew this was going to have the monumental effect that it did? While the network tried to secure a second debate, this time between Harris and Trump, the former president refused to engage, not meeting the deadline set by CNN for a formal response and saying it was too late. As both a journalist and as an American, I'm in favor of debates, and the more the better, Tapper says, adding that Trump's refusal is a shame, but has to do with political strategy. Trump, he says, made the calculation that it doesn't hurt him, and that in terms of cost-benefit, he's better off not doing it. Meanwhile, Harris is set to appear at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday for a town hall moderated by Anderson Cooper and featuring a live audience of persuadable and undecided voters. The opportunity was also extended to Trump to no avail, as the former president declined the network's invitation while recently participating in events hosted by Fox News and Univision. One major change at CNN since the 2020 election has taken place behind the scenes. This marks the first cycle under the leadership of CEO Mark Thompson, who was appointed to the role last year following the ouster of Chris Licht, who had succeeded Jeff Zucker, the network's boss during the last presidential election night. Tapper points out that while Thompson at the helm is a relatively new development, key members of the network's editorial leadership team have remained the same. Tapper name-checked Virginia Mosley, a longtime exec who was named to the new role of executive editor during earlier this year, and Eric Sherling, another CNN veteran who now serves as executive vice president of U.S. programming, as among those who have played critical roles in guiding CNN's political coverage behind the scenes. I think Mark has faith in us and is focused on the job at hand, the anchor said. I don't think that's going to be demonstrably different from how we've been encouraged to do things in the past, he adds. It's a pretty tight ship, and it's still chugging away, regardless of who the captain is. Meanwhile, the network's signature Magic Wall, which debuted in 2008, is getting a facelift for the big night. With each election since, we've made significant advances in how the Magic Wall powers our ability to bring audiences real-time results and the necessary context around what those results tell us as the election unfolds throughout the night, CNN's political director David Chalian tells me. In 2024, we are turbocharging those advancements with CNN's new digital Magic Wall, which now puts all of those critical real-time results and crucial historical and trend context directly in the hands of every single user. Speaking of historical context, Tapper says that viewers should be prepared to close out election night without a definitive result. That's not so unusual, he says, referencing the presidential elections of 2000, 2004, and 2020. It might take several days. He notes that the tighter the race, the longer it's going to take, adding that CNN will be doing 24/7 coverage for as many days as we need to be doing it. Here's what we know. It's going to take as long as it takes, Bash says. If the results turn out to be as tight as everyone is expecting, she adds, voters and viewers should just let the process play out because it could take a while. Every election night, Bash tells me, is intense and anxiety-provoking for viewers, though her hope is that the network can provide a place to take a breath and find out what's really going on amid a surge of misinformation across social media. We've been acutely aware of misinformation, disinformation, and we're doing our best to just tell the facts as we know them. Nothing more, nothing less. This next headline is on the down low. Donald Trump and Mike Johnson have a, quote, little secret election plan. This is by Caitlin Dewey on October 28th. Speaking to a crowd of supporters at New York's Madison Square Garden on Sunday, former President Donald Trump alluded to a secret plan that he said would help Republicans do really well in the House of Representatives. Some journalists and politicians have interpreted Trump's off-the-cuff remarks, delivered as he thanked House Speaker Mike Johnson for appearing at the MSG event, as a possible signal that Johnson is prepared to override the Electoral College should Vice President Kamala Harris win. I suspect Donald Trump's little secret plan with Mike Johnson is a backup plan for when he loses, Representative Dan Goldman said on CNN. Johnson, a central architect to the former president's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, is well positioned to launch such a challenge. Under the 12th Amendment, the House of Representatives selects the president if no candidate reaches 270 votes in the Electoral College. Each state delegation gets one vote. Republicans currently control the majority of them. We can take the Senate pretty easily, and I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right? Trump said, appearing to gesture to Johnson. Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over. Trump then abruptly moved on with his planned remarks, thanking CEO of Madison Square Garden. Trump and Johnson have become close political allies through the Louisiana congressman was not House Speaker under Trump. The two men reportedly speak often, and Johnson recently said that Trump fully supports him staying on for another term as Speaker if Republicans keep the House next month. If Democrats win the House next month, Hakeem Jeffries would likely be elected Speaker on January 3, 2025, just 3 days before presidential election results are certified in the House. In late 2020, Johnson, a constitutional lawyer, supported a Texas lawsuit to overturn the election results in four swing states. More than 100 House Republicans signed on to an amicus brief Johnson led. He later voted with 146 fellow Republicans to overturn the election results in Congress. Speaking at the Trump rally on Sunday, Johnson called House Republicans the only firewall between the American people and Washington Democrats, whom he misleadingly described as Marxists and socialists who hope to implement a European-styled Marxist and borderless socialist utopia in the U.S. We know we have to get Donald J. Trump back to the White House, and then we can get this thing fixed, Johnson said. On Monday, a new CNN-SSRS poll found that a vast majority of voters, 69%, believe that Trump will not concede the election if he loses in November. Almost 9 in 10 voters said that they believe the loser of the presidential election has an obligation to accept the vote. Next headline, J.D. Vance is trying to put a shine on Trump's MAGA muck. This is by Caitlin Dewey on October 25th. Former President Donald Trump and his Republican running mate J.D. Vance once again seem to be reading off entirely different scripts. Lately, Trump has doubled down on disturbing rhetoric about his political rivals, dubbing journalists and Democrats his sworn enemies, and floating vague future punishments. Meanwhile, Vance struck a much softer note at a town hall with News Nation on Thursday when asked how the winner of November's election should approach the losing side. "We have to set the tone," Vance said, without a trace of irony. "We're all Americans. We're all in this together. We're all part of the same American family." It's not the first time that Trump and Vance have appeared out of step on the campaign trail, perhaps on purpose. The Ohio senator and vice presidential nominee has recently emerged as a one-man cleanup crew for his running mate's more offensive rhetoric, reinterpreting Trump's off-the-cuff bombast for undecided voters and skeptical journalists. In recent weeks, for instance, Vance has attempted to explain Trump's comments about Vice President Kamala Harris's racial identity. "What I took it was an attack on Kamala Harris being a chameleon," Trump's repeat disparagement of Detroit. "He was just talking honestly about the fact that Detroit has been left behind," and his threat to use the military against his political enemies. Donald Trump is unfiltered. He speaks from the heart sometimes. That role has apparently come at personal cost for Vance. During his discussion of tone setting and American families on Thursday, the VP nominee mentioned that some of his and his wife's friends have gotten very personal about their political differences. "If you're discarding a lifelong friendship because somebody votes for the other team," he said, "then you've made a terrible, terrible mistake and you should do something different." Vance famously and vocally opposed Trump before he launched his own political career, something that one of his close former friends has spoken out about. Trump and Vance are, however, perfectly in sync on the subject of Trump now. Later in Thursday's town hall, Trump called in to ask Vance an easy question. How brilliant is Donald J. Trump? First of all, sir, you're very brilliant, Vance said. We both agree that it's important to have very smart people running our government. Bess Levin has had a lot to write about, as you can imagine, so I'm going to give her a little bit more time this week. Her first headline, literal billionaires are afraid to publicly endorse Kamala Harris for fear of retribution by Donald Trump. This is on the 23rd. As you've probably heard by now, there's a presidential election happening in less than 2 weeks. Voters will have the choice to vote for Kamala Harris, who has never incited a deadly attack on the Capitol or fawned over dictators, or Donald Trump, who even Republicans have said was responsible for the 2021 insurrection that left multiple people dead, and who has never encountered a dictator he didn't admire, including Adolf Hitler. In other words, the fate of democracy is very much on the line, and the candidate who isn't openly pro-fascism could use as much help as she can get, given that the polls somehow show a neck-and-neck race. And yet, despite the very grave stakes, at least two powerful billionaires who privately support the vice president are apparently too frightened of Trump and the blowback of going against him to publicly endorse Harris. One of those billionaires is J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, an extremely outspoken executive who the New York Times reported Tuesday has made clear in private that he supports Vice President Kamala Harris, but isn't making his stance known publicly because he is fearful that if Mr. Trump is victorious, he could retaliate against the people and companies who publicly opposed his run. In a statement, a spokesperson for J.P. Morgan said Dimon, a registered Democrat, has never publicly endorsed a presidential candidate, but he speaks out forcefully and often on policies to help strengthen our country and lift up communities. According to two people familiar with his private conversations, Dimon has told fellow Wall Street Journal executives that while he is a backer of Harris, he has a duty to J.P. Morgan shareholders to protect the public company from potential political retaliation. The other billionaire, and a billionaire many times over to be exact, that supports Harris but is afraid of the repercussions of publicly saying so, is Microsoft founder Bill Gates. Also on Tuesday, The Times reported that after decades of sitting on the sidelines of politics, Bill Gates, one of the richest people in the world, has said privately that he recently donated about $50 million to a nonprofit organization that is supporting Vice President Kamala Harris's presidential run. That $50 million will no doubt have been appreciated by the campaign, but the fact that it was reportedly meant to stay under wraps, and that Gates has also chosen not to publicly endorse Harris, is more than a little concerning. According to The Times, the multi-million-dollar check went to Future Forward USA Action, an organization that does not disclose donor names. As The Times notes, Gates has long sought to hold himself above politics so that he could have credibility with both Democratic and Republican audiences and administrations. In a statement to the outlet, Gates stressed his bipartisanship, saying, "I support candidates who demonstrate a clear commitment to improving health care, reducing poverty, and fighting climate change in the U.S. and around the world. I have a long history of working with leaders across the political spectrum, but this election is different, with unprecedented significance for Americans and the most vulnerable people around the world," which, reading between the lines, might as well be an endorsement of Harris. Yet Gates conspicuously chose not to say so. All of which you might kind of be able to understand. Trump has threatened to go after people who don't support him on numerous occasions and has literally threatened campaign donors. This month, he said the U.S. military should be used against the enemy from within if necessary, and over the weekend confirmed that the phrase refers to his American political opponents. And yet, that's all the more reason for people like Gates and Dimon to vocally support Harris and do anything they can, including making public endorsements, to prevent her opponent from retaking the White House, where, if he is to be believed, he'll start going after people who didn't kiss the ring on day one, and who knows what else. Next Bess Levin headline, Elon Musk gets a reminder from the DOJ that paying people to vote is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Wondering whether or not Elon Musk's little election giveaway stunt, wherein the richest man in the world is pledged to give $1 million a day to petition signing registered voters as part his attempt to get Donald Trump elected is legal? Wonder no longer. It is very likely is not, according to the Department of Justice, which got in touch with Musk this week. In a letter sent days after he announced the sweepstakes, Robert Herbely, the head of the DOJ's election crimes branch, told Musk that offering anything of monetary value to influence voters violates federal law. The letter was first reported by the 24-site newsletter that has been confirmed by other news outlets. The letter reportedly did not specify any immediate legal action, but did spell out the penalties for breaking U.S. voting laws, including possible imprisonment of up to 5 years. On the website for Musk's America PAC, the petition that would-be $1 million recipients are required to sign reads, "The First and Second Amendments guarantee freedoms of speech and right to bear arms. By signing below, I am pledging my support for the First and Second Amendments." It also says, "Our goal is to get 1 million registered voters in swing states to sign in support of the Constitution, especially freedom of speech and the right to bear arms. This program is exclusively open to registered voters in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. Expires November 5th. 4 people, 3 in Pennsylvania and 1 in North Carolina, have been awarded money so far. Most recently, Andy from Holly Springs, North Carolina, whom Musk congratulated on Wednesday. A DOJ spokesman declined the New York Times request for comment. Musk, his super PAC, and its lawyers have not responded to requests for comment. Rick Hasen, the director of the UCLA School of Law's Safeguarding Democracy Project, wrote on his blog Saturday that Musk's plan is clearly illegal because the petition stipulates signers are registered voters in certain states. Speaking at a rally in Wisconsin on Tuesday, Tim Walz called Musk a dipshit and told the crowd, "That guy is literally the richest man in the world, and he's spending millions of dollars to help Donald Trump buy an election." The next one is a creepy headline. "You've been a bad little girl. Tucker Carlson gave the most WTF speech of all time at a campaign event for Trump." Republicans have said a lot of weird, wildly disturbing things in their time, but perhaps nothing has come close to the creepiness that was on display on Wednesday night when former Fox News host Tucker Carlson told a crowd of Donald Trump supporters that the ex-president needs to give America, which he likened to a hormone-addled 15-year-old girl, a vigorous spanking. Yes, at a campaign event in Georgia, Carlson opined that Americans under Democratic leadership have been allowed to act like a toddler smearing the contents of his diaper on the wall of your living room, or a hormone-addled 15-year-old daughter slamming the door of her bedroom and giving her parents the finger. And then he said, "There has to be a point at which dad comes home, and if you've recently consumed lunch, consider pausing for an hour or two before hearing what Carlson had to say next, or at least have a barf bag at the ready. When dad gets home, you know what he says?" Carlson asked the crowd. "You've been a bad girl. You've been a bad little girl, and you're getting a vigorous spanking right now." A huge grin on his face, he continued. "And no, it's not going to hurt me more than it hurts you. No, it's not. I'm not going to lie. This is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts me. And you earned this. You're getting a vigorous spanking because you've been a bad girl." Because this was a Trump rally, instead of responding with stunned looks of "what the fuck did he say?", the crowd broke into rapturous applause at the idea of Trump meting out corporal punishment on a 15-year-old and calling her a bad girl in the process. Later, and again, grab that barf bag, the ex-president's supporters addressed him as "daddy." Incredibly, Carlson's extended metaphor wasn't the only time he had something weird to say about the young women last night. Referring to Liz Cheney, Carlson called the 58-year-old former GOP representative Dick Cheney's creepy little daughter. Our next headline, Donald Trump calls America a garbage can of undocumented immigrants in racist, even for him, campaign rally. "A shining city on a hill, an exceptional, great nation, the land of a second chance. A brilliant diversity spreads like stars, like 1,000 points of light in a broad and peaceful sky." These are just some of the ways former presidents have described America over the years. And then there's Donald Trump. On Thursday, at a rally in Arizona, the ex-president, who you might be surprised to hear would like to be president again, described the country as a garbage can, the contents of which, according to him, are undocumented immigrants. While the president has long spoken of people who weren't born in America and anyone he disagrees with in the most dehumanizing terms possible, his remarks on Thursday were somehow disturbing, even for him. "A lot of people coming out of the Congo," Trump told the crowd in Tempe. "Not just South America. They're coming from 181 countries as of yesterday. We're a dumping ground. We're like a garbage can for the world. That's what's happened. We're like a garbage can. You know, that's the first time I've ever said that. First time I've ever said garbage can. But you know what? It's a very accurate description." Since he announced his first run for office in 2015 during a speech in which he described Mexican people as bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, Trump has talked about immigrants, usually those of the undocumented variety, though he's clearly no fan of legal ones either, using racist, stomach-churning rhetoric. Just some of that rhetoric has included claiming migrants are poisoning the blood of our country and dubbing them as animals who have wrecked America. Most recently, he's taken to spreading dangerous lies that Haitian immigrants are eating people's pets in Springfield, Ohio. Of course, the language is not just reserved for people from other countries, but anyone Trump has defined as one of his enemies. On Thursday, he called Joe Biden a stupid fool, called Nancy Pelosi crazy as a bedbug, dubbed Gavin Newsom the worst, accused Kamala Harris of gross incompetence, called journalists the enemy of the people. The same day, in an apparent attempt to really drive home the idea that he would govern like a fascist in a second term, Trump called into a town hall J.D. Vance was doing on News Nation to ask, in the third person, how brilliant is Donald Trump? Vance, who has previously described Trump as America's Hitler, responded, "Sir, of course, you're very brilliant." And our last Levin headline, Trump says Jack Smith should be thrown out of the country, suggesting he believes you can deport American citizens and that in a second term, he'll try. Donald Trump on Thursday gave voters a preview of what America would look like should he win a second term when he declared that Jack Smith, the prosecutor running two federal cases against him, should be thrown out of the country. "We should throw Jack Smith out with them, the mentally deranged people. Jack Smith should be considered mentally deranged and he should be thrown out of the country," Trump said during an interview with a conservative radio talk show. Setting aside the idea that Trump apparently believes mental illness is a reason to kick people out of the U.S., he appears to also think that the U.S. government can deport American citizens and that, given the opportunity, he would try. The ex-president's comments regarding Smith being thrown out of the country came hours after he said in an interview that he would fire the special prosecutor within 2 seconds. Earlier this month, Trump started warning about the need for using the military against the enemy from within, which he initially defined as Democratic lawmakers like California Representative Adam Schiff, but later said referred to anyone that doesn't support him. In response to Trump's latest comments, a spokesperson for Kamala Harris's campaign said in a statement, "A second Trump term where a more unstable and unhinged Trump has essentially no guardrails and is surrounded by loyalists who will enable his worst instincts is guaranteed to be more dangerous. America can't risk a second Trump term." During a town hall with CNN on Wednesday, Harris said she believes Trump is a fascist and represents a danger to the well-being and security of the United States of America. The VP's remarks followed a warning from John Kelly, a retired four-star general, and Trump's former chief of staff that his ex-boss is an authoritarian who holds Adolf Hitler in high regard, a claim that Trump has denied. At this time, you might be wondering if Republicans have anything to say about all of this, and the answer is they do. Specifically, they think that Harris needs to abandon the base as irresponsible rhetoric that endangers both American lives and institutions. As GOP leaders Mitch McConnell and Mike Johnson wrote in the most shameless joint statement of all time, which they released on Friday, did McConnell and Johnson have anything to say about Trump calling for the military to be used against people who don't support him or threatening to deport a U.S. citizen? You probably already know the answer to that. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster. Thanks so much for listening and join me next week. Have a great week, everybody.